for the love of goats. We are talking about everything goat. Whether you're a goat owner, a breeder, or just a fan of these wonderful creatures, we've got you covered. And now, here's Deborah Neiman.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's episode. This topic is one that is near and dear to my heart, as we had so many goats that died from parasites 15 plus years ago when we were still getting started with our goats. And we discovered dewormer resistance firsthand and basically just watched Mother Nature cull our herd because none of the dewormers worked anymore for us. And that is actually what led me to, as I say, accidentally become a goat expert, because I personally wound up digging into the research and reading the studies. And by the time I learned enough to save my own goats, I had literally discovered enough to write a whole book. And so that's what I did. So the end of April, we had a post on Facebook that went a little viral with some people getting really upset. And there were a number of people who popped into the conversation mentioning a lot of myths and misunderstandings about worms and dewormers. So I thought, who better to help us with this topic than Dr. Michael Posato from Mississippi State University, who has been with us before. He was with us when the American Consortium for Small Ruminant Parasite Control revised their dewormer chart in 2021, and multiple episodes since then. So today we are going to talk about myths and misconceptions that are still out there and how they're not quite right, where they came from, and what the best practices are today. Welcome to today's show, Dr. Posato.
Thank you, Deborah. As always, I'm happy to be here. And this is also a topic near and dear to my heart, especially since I think a lot of times myths and misunderstandings tend to dominate the ideology behind parasite control. So I'm excited to dispel some of these myths with you today.
Thank you so much. So first of all, let's start with one of the basics. You know, a lot of times we tell people to go to the consortium's website because they have a lot of great information there. And one of the things they talk about is smart deworming. So some people do go there and they read it, and then they use these terms online and they don't explain what the term means. And then other people just kind of assume they know what it means. So one of the things that came up in that particular conversation is somebody said that smart deworming means that you do a fecal to know which dewormer to use, because if you use the wrong dewormer, you'll wind up with dewormer resistance. And pretty much everything about that statement is incorrect. So could you explain to us, like, what exactly does smart deworming mean?
Absolutely. So smart deworming is another term for selected deworming or targeted deworming. And essentially, this is a concept that says to utilize both animal and fecal assessment when it comes to choosing to deworm. Not necessarily choosing the dewormer class or type that you're using, but selecting the animals that should be dewormed. So one example for animal assessment that we use is FAMACHA scoring, which, as some of you may remember, or hopefully a lot of you know, this is a chart that we use to assess the lower eyelid mucous membranes. And essentially what we're looking for is anemia. So this is a Homuncus contortus barbipole worm specific screening tool. And that's kind of one of the mainstays of our animal assessment. And so essentially you're looking at this card, and the card typically has five different colors on it, with one being the best, the brightest red, and five being the white, the kind of ghost color, the, oh gosh, this animal's going to die. And we typically say that if they're in the kind of red and pink, we leave them alone. We do not deworm them. If we're looking at animals that are kind of getting in that pale whitish color, that's when we're going to talk about starting to maybe deworm. Now, typically we want to see this associated also with a fecal. So for example, let's say that we have an animal that has a really high FAMACHA score. They're very white colored. We may want to deworm them, but we also want to run a fecal at the same time. And we just want to see what the egg count looks like. It's going to give us an idea how severely parasitized this animal was, let us know that we did make the right call in that case. And then we can utilize that information later on down the line. Now, the only thing I could think of with this comment that was made is referencing what's called a fecal egg count reduction test. This still does not tell us exactly what dewormer to use. Unfortunately, I wish it was that simple. I wish there was something that was an easy button. You hit it and it'd say, yes, give Panacure. Yes, give Valbazin. But there isn't, unfortunately, an easy button that you can hit. So I think what this comment may have been looking at is the fecal egg count reduction test. Essentially what this is, it's another fecal we run 2 weeks after the initial deworming. And this second fecal tells us how much that dewormer actually worked. It doesn't tell us, of course, which one to use initially. And I think that's where this person maybe got lost. I'm not entirely sure, but that's where I think this person got lost. There is no such thing as a fecal that will tell you which dewormer to use. So the smart deworming is going to allow us to utilize more evidence when it comes to selecting who to deworm. It's going to help us to avoid deworming the entire group of animals. So we're trying to just pick the ones that look like they absolutely need it. Another animal assessment tool that we'll use is body condition scoring, right? So looking at how skinny they are, right? So there's multiple types of animal assessment we can do that looks for signs of gastrointestinal parasitism, specifically targeting Homuncus contortus, but also looking at the other two kind of severe nematodes that cause disease amongst small ruminants, goats and sheep specifically. But there is no such thing as a specific fecal that's going to tell us, hey, use this class of dewormer.
I think where that came from is that another big myth out there is that some dewormers kill some worms, but not other worms. And the reality is that all the dewormers kill all the worms except for tapeworm. And tapeworm, you can see in the poop. So you don't even need a fecal for tapeworm. And tapeworm doesn't make goats sick. So if a goat is sick, like if there, it doesn't make them anemic and stuff like that. So if your goat is anemic and has poor body condition and all of that, then it's one of those other worms that all of the dewormers do kill.
Correct. And I think, you know, we'll get into this. You're right. Absolutely. All of our dewormers are labeled to kill all of those nematodes. And where we've run into the problem, of course, is with resistance, which we'll dive more into as we go through the myths.
Yeah. And then somebody brought up the topic of lungworms. They're like, oh, well, not all dewormers kill lungworms. And I'm like, well, that doesn't have the same symptoms as intestinal worms.
Exactly. That's a totally different ball game. Just like tapeworms, I mean, it's interesting because I think we think parasites, right? And some people associate parasitism with all of the parasites and they all cause the same thing. But it's, again, it's not that simple or straightforward, right? So as you mentioned, lungworms are a totally different ballgame. There's very different clinical signs associated with them. Anemia is not a classic clinical sign associated with lungworms. So we would actually not select a dewormer for lungworms based on the same criteria we selected for, you know, Homuncus, barber pole worm. So when you start adding more piles of parasites on there, it's going to make it more and more complex and more complicated.
Yeah, I think where a lot of people get confused about that is I think that people use the terms parasite and worm interchangeably sometimes. And if you've got a kid that's like between 3 weeks and 5 months of age and it's got diarrhea and stuff, in that case, you may need a fecal to know if it's worms or coccidia.
Exactly.
Because those are not treated with the same drugs because coccidia are not worms. They are a parasite, but not worms.
Absolutely. I actually think that's a fantastic way to look at it and kind of a fantastic example, because you're right. Not all parasites are worms. And, you know, it gets very confusing when we're not using the proper terminology. For example, I use the word nematode. Nematode means worm. I typically use gastrointestinal nematode, which just means worms of the GI tract, right? And that way I can kind of differentiate between the lungworm or the meningeal worm or something like another parasite that's not a worm, like a liver fluke or a coccidia, for example. So I think that's a really great example of where we can get confused because some of these parasites do not respond to the same treatment that our worms respond to.
Exactly. So one of the things that I think is really interesting, we say this a lot, like do not deworm on a schedule. And then I've even had people say to me, oh, I don't deworm on a schedule. I just do it twice a year. Or I don't deworm on a schedule, but then they tell you that they will give a dewormer to a goat a week after they gave it the first dose. And those are schedules. So like anything that involves the calendar is a schedule. So can you explain why we don't want to do anything based on the calendar?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So when you look at deworming your small ruminant, your sheep, your goat, you really have to be careful that we're not getting into the habit of doing what we call blanket deworming. So if on your farm, you take all the goats and you deworm everybody at the exact same time, no matter when it is time of year, that's going to be a negative, right? And so when it comes to calendar-based deworming or scheduled deworming, or I just do it when it gets cold outside, or I just do it after they give birth, but I give it to everybody on the farm, all that's doing is helping to drive the resistance development amongst the parasite, the worm itself, the gastrointestinal nematode. So the worm I'm talking about primarily is barberpole. Homoncus contortus barberpole worm is the fastest parasite to develop resistance that we have seen so far. And I think that that's the one obviously causing most of the problems, most of the death loss for most farms. So that barberpole worm is going to be exposed at least once, twice, three times, maybe four times, however many times a year, to that dewormer. And every time that happens, every time you get exposure, there are more and more resistant populations that are growing. So for example, let's say it happens every year. By like the 10th year, you're not going to have any parasites or barberpole worms that will respond to the dewormer. So doing on a calendar, all that's doing is helping to push forward faster the development of resistance in the actual worms themselves, the barberpole worms themselves. So I really do not like calendar-based anything. There should never be a certain time of year that you deworm. You can always do FEMATRA scoring and fecals at a certain time of year. So let's say you know that the transition from winter into spring is very challenging for your animals and you always seem to have parasite problems. Well, then let's assess them more commonly in those months. Check their FEMATRA score, look at their body condition score, collect fecals, check and see if it's coccidia, right? It could be coccidia, it could be any number of parasites that are not related to the barberpole worm. That is acceptable. So planning to check your animals, pay attention to your animals at certain times of year is acceptable. Choosing to deworm just strictly because it is that time of year is not acceptable. And as Deborah's already brought up, and I think it's great that Sherry touched on this, wormx.info, the American Consortium for Small Ruminant Parasite Control, there is an abundance of literature that's been published from all over the country, all over the world. We have international members that shows how things like blanket deworming, scheduled deworming practices are leading to increased resistance development and failure of treatment of those parasites. So stay away from the calendar. The only thing I would recommend if you're going to use a calendar is, hey, I'm going to check the goats more frequently, but I'm not going to plan to just deworm them because that's going to be bad news.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like it's really easy for me to keep an eye on my milkers because they're on the milk stand every day. And it's just a habit for me that like I close the head gate and I run my hand down their spine. Yeah. So like I'm doing a body check on my does twice a day.
Exactly.
You know? And if they start to feel thin, then I'm like, you know, their head is already locked into this tension. And I just go pull down the eyelid to see how the eyelid moves.
Well, and I think that's a good point. You know, if you have a pet goat at home or a herd of pet goats, and you know, you brush them. I've had clients who brush their goats every day. That's a great time for you to put your hands on them, get them used to the FEMATRA score. If you don't, that's okay. If you've got, let's say, goats that are out browsing most of the time or that keep up yards or do landscaping jobs, run them in and check them out during peak season of parasites, which we're going to say, depending on where you are in the country, it can vary, but basically it's when we start getting into the summer months. So I'd say April, May, depending on where you are, all the way into October, November, depending on where you are. Make sure you just run them in and check them as frequently as you can, once a week if you can, right? If you can't, then once every 2 weeks. At least just lay eyes on them. As Deborah said, lay hands on them. That's really important. Your goats can get fluffy, right? So after that winter time, put your hands on these animals. Just saying, okay, well, it's April, time to deworm. That is a really bad practice. And what I'll tell you is that, yes, that used to happen. That used to be completely acceptable. If we go back to when these dewormers first hit the market, it was encouraged. So if you're following your parents, your grandparents, whatever they used to do, unfortunately, that is now something that has evolved beyond giving regularly like that. So science changes all the time. And with barberpole worm, because of its ability to develop resistance, we've seen a change from what was recommended 20 years ago, maybe 30 years ago, to what we recommend now. And I think that's what's important to remember, because I know that some of you out there who post some of this stuff, you're coming from a place where you did learn this stuff, but it might be outdated. And so it's important to stay up to date. And I think Deborah does a great job in her podcast keeping you guys up to date and recommending resources of value to keep you up to date and not just following what dad and mom or granddad and grandma did back in the day.
Yeah, I love it. Susan Shanian was on here one time and talked about how back in the 80s when she got started, about how they used to deworm every single animal. And, you know, if it was your turn to deworm and you missed an animal, you had to buy lunch for everybody. So like that was just best practice. 30
Yeah. Years. Oh, absolutely. And I think I love Susan. She's a fantastic resource, you know, and I am glad that she shared that story, because some of you out there, that's what you were taught to do. And I understand that, you know, we're not trying to demonize you or make fun of you. You know, we want you to understand that things have changed, things have progressed. And unfortunately, we're literally fighting a battle against barber pole worm, and we're losing because of these old school practices. We're losing. So Deborah and I today, we're trying to dispel these myths so that we kind of have an upper hand in this battle. And we kind of teach you guys that the old practices may not just be as reliable anymore.
One of the things that is really frustrating is that sometimes people will send me a link to somebody's website who's like in Colorado or Arizona or the mountains of California. And they talk about how they deworm their goats on a schedule and they do all of the things. I'm not even going to list them all, but they do all of the things that were very common 20 or 30 years ago. And they say, we've been doing this for 20 or 30 years and this works. And it's like, no, you've actually been wasting your money for 20 or 30 years, because where you live, nobody has a problem with barber pole worms, because you're either in a drought state or you're in the desert or you're in the mountains and your goats are eating browse all day long. Mm-hmm. They're not in the rainy parts of the country where the goats are forced to be grazers. And as I say, eating from their toilet.
Yeah. Oh, and I think it's great you bring that up, because the reality of this country is that we have so many different kind of climates. We have different geographic entities that make our environment very different. So if you're in Pennsylvania or Maryland or Mississippi, you probably shouldn't be looking at a website for someone that's in Colorado or someone that's in Arizona or California or Nevada. Keep in mind that these different places where people are doing this, it may look nothing like your farm. And trying to follow those recommendations, it's going to be a disservice to you. And I agree, they're wasting their money. And honestly, they don't even know, like you said, if those dewormers have done anything or if it's just the fact they don't have the parasites, you know. And these dewormers, they're not cheap. If you're doing this often, they get very expensive. You know, I mean, we're looking at pushing into, for some of the really good, quote unquote, what people think are good dewormers, we're looking at pushing into over $100 for a bottle. That starts to eat into your production costs or just whatever small scale spending money that you have. It starts to eat into that. So it's important to remember that and know your sources.
Yeah, exactly. And I've had people contact me more than once who lived in one of those places and then moved to the East Coast. And within months, they have goats dying from worms. And they contact me and say, I don't understand why I have goats dying from worms. I've been raising goats for 10 years or 15 years. I've never lost a goat. We just moved to, you know, South Carolina or whatever from Northern California. And it's like, okay, that's why you've got animals dying from worms now, because you are in worm central.
Yeah. Well, and my students told me once that I was flexing on somebody, because I was talking to somebody and they were telling me, it was a producer, and they were telling me, you know, I've had goats, I've raised goats for 30 years. And, you know, I told them, I said, look, I understand that you have raised goats for 30 years, but you've raised goats on this one property for 30 years. I have practiced in Pennsylvania, Maryland, Delaware, Mississippi, and Alabama. I've seen thousands of goat farms across the kind of East Coast. And I can tell you right now that, you know, your one farm experience is not the normal experience of all of the other farms around you. So it's important to remember that just because something works really well for that one person doesn't mean that it's going to work for your farm and that you should follow it verbatim. You know, you should try and look at what your animals look like, how many you have, where you're located, what they're eating, other health issues you've had in the past. All these things relate to potentially what your parasite load is going to look like. So it's really important not to get lulled into this false sense of security of like, well, so-and-so has been doing it for 20 years. Yeah, but they've been doing it on this isolated little vacuum. You're not in their vacuum. You know, be careful, because that can be very detrimental to your goats and your production model or pets or whatever you're into, to follow somebody who's not the same as you.
Yeah. And somebody else I knew had a farm in Tennessee that was covered with Lespediza. Yeah. And luckily she knew that, you know, she's yeah. like, you know, I'm so excited. My farm is covered with Lespediza. I have no parasite problems. But if she didn't know that, you know, and she was giving her goats a dewormer on a regular basis, she might just think, oh, my goats are doing good because I'm giving them this dewormer. When in reality, it's because she's got like the world's best natural dewormer growing all over her farm.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that's the other thing, you know, that's what always blows me away a little bit. People being like, well, 1 + 1 = 2, you know, and this is exactly why this happened, when we actually don't know, right? We don't have any evidence. It's all anecdotal. It's all kind of like whatever story you wanted to tell, right? But there's no evidence to back up a claim like that. So I think some of those sites, some of those postings can be overconfident. And as you know, Deborah, it's a lot of responsibility when you're talking to the country or to the world. And to make a blanket statement like that can be very dangerous, especially for those who are just trying to find an answer. They're just trying to find the right answer.
Yeah. And that's why, like I said, you know, like that's why I think it's just so important for people to understand the research and to know the why. Because otherwise you look at these different farms doing different things, and it's just super confusing. You're like, because sometimes people don't know why they don't have a problem, just like people who have a problem don't know why they have the problem.
Exactly. Exactly.
One of the things that I discovered is still really, really popular when I made that post is that a lot of people think that you really have to do a second deworming after the first deworming. And Tammy Gallagher, who also helps me answer questions on there, she is also a certified FEMATCHA instructor like I am. And we kept saying, unless you have dewormer resistance on your farm, a single dose of the dewormers at the correct dosage is sufficient to take care of whatever worm load your goat has. And so many people got really upset about that with all sorts of different comments and assumptions and stuff, and saying, you know, show me the study that shows that you should only do it once. And it's like, well, there's not a study that says you should only do it once. It's about your overall parasite management program and the fact that you don't need a second deworming. And this is where I don't like the idea, even when people say like, oh, give them a dewormer and wait 10 days to do a fecal. It's like, if an animal's really parasitized and you give them a dewormer, like you need to put them in the barn off of the pasture that's covered with larvae and be checking them every single day and make sure that they are improving. Because if you just think, oh, in a week or two, I'm going to repeat a dewormer or do a fecal or something like that, they could be dead long exactly. before that. So exactly. can you talk about why it's not recommended to do a second deworming routinely?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So this is a really great point. And I've had a lot of clients tell me that this is what they were doing. And you and I were having a little discussion about this, because I always find it interesting just looking at what arbitrary day gets thrown out. So, you know, 7 days, 10 days, 2 weeks, you know, some people like to do it every 21 days. And the reality is that if I had a bunch of these barber pole worms that were there and susceptible to the dewormer, and I gave them the initial dose of dewormer, and I killed off, let's say, 85% of them, well, those are the only worms that are going to respond. That's it. So if I waited and I gave another dose in 7 days, the ones that were still alive from that initial deworming are not going to die. And I know a lot of people say, oh, well, the larvae that have matured, they're going to die then. Well, there's different stages all throughout the time frame going on. We don't know. It's not like, oh, there's one wave of adults and now here's another larval wave of adults coming in. So that second deworming dose, actually, there may not be a large number of larval maturation that happened in that 7 days, or there may be no larval maturation that happened in that 7 days. You don't know, right? There's no evidence out there that shows that there is a benefit to giving that second follow-up dose at an arbitrary date. So what you're doing is saying, okay, resistant parasites, here comes another wave of dewormer for you to enjoy. And by the way, there might be a couple more adults that are probably resistant as well. So you enjoy that as well. And we end up creating more of that resistance. Now, I will say there's one thing, and I want to just talk about this briefly. So when we look at the white wormers, the Valbazin, the Panicure, the Safeguard, I had a few people that were telling me that they were giving those dewormers once a day for 3 days in a row. And I was like, I've heard this so many times. I'm going to ask one of our kind of renowned parasitologists, Dr. Ray Kaplan. Give a shout out to Dr. Ray Kaplan. I'm going to ask him if he thinks that that's something that people should be doing, because I've heard it from multiple sources. And Dr. Kaplan actually wrote back and said, the resistance development to the fenbendazole and albendazole, which is the Panicure Safeguard and the Valbazin, is so severe that sometimes giving 3 days in a row has more efficacy than changing the dose amount or giving it over long periods of time. And I was like, oh, that's really interesting. He said, but that all depends on the resistance on the farm and how severe it is. So I still do not go out recommending that we do multi-day therapy. I definitely do not recommend multi-day therapy for any dewormer that is outside of that first class, the white wormer class, that includes, you know, your moxidectin or cydectin, which is one of the quote unquote stronger dewormers, your prohibit or levamisole, one of the stronger dewormers. All you're doing is driving that resistance to develop a heck of a lot faster. And honestly, you're wasting your money. People have done the 21 day. So the pre-patent period, that's a scientific term for the time it takes for the barber pole worm to become an adult and cause clinical signs. So it's the time basically from when it enters the body to when it develops from a larvae to the adult to cause the anemia, to cause the weight loss. Now, some people have said, oh, well, then I'll deworm every 21 days. Well, that's kind of ludicrous, right? You're never going to catch every single one. So it's almost like trying to, you know, put sand into a net and hope that it stays. It's just not going to happen. So it's a slippery slope. And as Deborah said, there are studies out there looking at a ton of different dewormers in different parts of the country that look at the resistance patterns on different farms, that look at giving, you know, one dose versus multi-dose. This is all a library of literature that has come together to formulate what Deborah and I have talked about this entire talk about smart deworming, about proper use of anthelmintics or dewormers. This library of knowledge is pretty much all available on wormx.info. It's unfortunately not just like a quick Google come up with your best article situation. It may take a little bit of digging to find your exact pinpoint article, but I can almost guarantee you that there has been some studies that look into this and that has support the evidence that we're talking about today.
So the other thing too, I don't know if we said this actually, is that some people used to say, I don't hear it as much, I do still hear it occasionally, that second deworming kills the eggs that hatch inside the goat since the first deworming. And that's like not relevant at all because eggs hatch on the pasture.
Correct, exactly. In the barber pole, the eggs are hatching in the pasture. The larvae are already at a certain maturation stage when they enter into the host. And then, like I said, it's tough to say where they are at the time you gave that dewormer. Again, it's like putting sand in a net. You're trying to figure out, when am I going to deworm to catch the most that I possibly... Well, it's not going to happen. They're just all over the place all the time. They're in the animal developing, and there are potentially thousands of them in the animal developing. So it's like chasing your tail to do this, to pick an arbitrary number and give a second dose.
Yeah, I think I used to hear some numbers. So I think people had the idea that there was a number, and I don't think it was based on research. I think it was just an assumption that people made, mm-hmm. You know, like, oh, those larvae are going to mature in 7 days, or the eggs will hatch in 7 days or 10 days or 14 days or whatever. And the reality is we don't know, because larvae can be in that arrested stage for months.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's the thing, you know, we're not even talking about larvae that are overwintering. You know, there's so many parts to this story that if it was as simple as to give a second dose in a certain amount of days, we wouldn't be dealing with these problems.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the things that somebody said, which she linked to a 2006 PDF from Purdue University, which I want to talk about Google at some point today, because Google is not our friend here. And Google still sends people to these old, old articles. And so I read through the article and I think she misunderstood some stuff that she read there. But she said that there are inhibited worms that are burrowed into the tissue of the digestive system and they come out, and that that second deworming is going to kill them.
Ah, yes. So we're starting to confuse another parasite. So it is a gastrointestinal nematode. It is a worm. However, it is not Haemonchus contortus. It's not barber pole. It's actually a parasite called Ostracagia or Chelidorsagia. And this is a parasite that in cattle is very, very classic for, it actually goes into the gastric glands in the abomasum, which is the kind of true stomach of the cow. And it can come out normally during a season that is weather-wise better for the parasite. We do see Chelidorsagia, which is the name of it, in small ruminants, but not to the pathogenic extent that we see it in cattle. So if we're talking about these, you know, encysted worms and them coming out, there actually wouldn't be a good way to tell how many days it would take for that to happen, especially because depending on where you are in the country, depends on when those worms come out. So, for example, if you're in the south, it's actually more comfortable in the fall for those parasites because they like it cooler, unlike barber pole, which loves it hot. If you're in the north, they come out more in the summertime because in the winter, it's too cold. So I'm already feel like I'm getting deeper, right, than where we need to be, which is the reality of it, that that article is talking about a totally different parasite than barber pole, than what we're mainly concerned about. Not to say that Chelidorsagia does not cause some clinical signs, but I would go ahead and say that we're primarily concerned with the Haemonchus or barber pole worm, and that that article was not discussing that parasite going into what we call hypobiotic state, because it's not as common with a barber pole worm.
Yeah, there were a few things I read in there that I was like, that's interesting. This is definitely from 2008, because it talks about larvae crawling up on the grass.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, larvae can't crawl.
Yeah. And that's the thing, you know, Google is funny. And I know Deborah and I were talking a little bit about this too. Google is funny because I think you could find evidence to support whatever you want on Google. Honestly, you could say that the sky is green and find something, some post somewhere on the internet, probably backed by maybe something legit that says, yes, the sky is green until you see it with your eyes and then it's blue, you know, or something weird like that, some loophole. So be very careful with the literature you're reading. Make sure that, one, it's coming from a reliable source, which Purdue is a reliable source, you know, and that's tricky. But two, make sure that it's not from more than 10 years ago, right? I mean, 10 years is even pushing it, to be honest, in parasite control and small ruminants. The kind of more updated research probably is going to come from the last 5 to 7 years. So if you're seeing something from the early 2000s, I would double check your resource and make sure that that's not outdated information.
Yeah. And a lot of people don't realize that they need to look for a date when they find something, because Google is dumb. It's just an algorithm. You know, it's like, oh, millions of people have gone to this page, so it must be good. And so they keep sending people to these really old pages that have been out there for like 15 years, because people go there and then they spend a long time there. It's like if somebody goes to a page and then they click off within 10 or 20 seconds, Google does not see that as a reliable page. But if somebody's looking for parasite information and they see, oh, Purdue, they stay there and they don't realize that page just got lost on the Purdue website. Like, Purdue's not linking to it from any of their pages. They just forgot about it.
Exactly. Well, and I think, you know, one thing it's important to remember too about Google is that sometimes keep an eye out. If it says sponsored, that source paid for it to be at the top. So be careful clicking on any kind of sponsored pages. You may find this, you know, with certain businesses, for example, that are trying to get you to come and check out what products they have, that they may also post information. They're kind of putting a little bit of money out there so that they can be at the top of your list when you Google it. The other thing to keep in mind, you know, is I think it's a great point that Deborah brought up, that things can get lost. So with the consortium, we're actually right now in the process of going through our own library and updating. Literally, we just talked about this at our most recent meeting. Our goal is to go through all of our literature, read it for accuracy, and edit it as needed with the edits reposted for that article, because we've realized that the consortium has been around for a long time now, and there's a lot of information out there that has changed. And so I think it's important that you just pay attention. You know, you could find the original published date, but make sure it says edited or reviewed or examined or something by a hopefully reliable source in the last decade.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I wouldn't want to go to the doctor and have them treating me with information that was current 20 years ago.
I know, exactly. Science evolves all the time. We have to keep that in mind.
Yeah. Speaking of that, you know, everybody talks about how hard it is to find a vet who treats goats, who knows goats and stuff. And I always tell people, please do not try to convince your dog and cat vet to see your goats. Because as a very brave vet said to me, you know, like 18 years ago or so, she said, I would not be doing you any favors by seeing your goats. Mm-hmm. And after seeing some of the things that, you know, small animal vets have said to people about their goats, I'm like, she was right. And I really respect her. I was not happy at the time, but now, like, I really respect the fact that she said, I'm not a goat vet. So can we talk a little bit about continuing education for vets? Because so many people think like, oh, if my vet said this, it absolutely has to be right. Especially if the vet's like been practicing for 20 or 30 years. Like, they really know, kind of like somebody who's been raising goats for 20 or 30 years. They must really know.
Yep.
So can you talk a little bit about continuing education?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So this is a nice topic, because obviously as a veterinarian, this is something that I have to go through every year. So continuing education, it's required for veterinarians to maintain their veterinary license. And I first off have to say, I commend your veterinarian for her honesty. I think that really that's a sign of a good veterinarian, to be honest about where they feel their skills lie, right? My goal as a veterinarian teacher is to try and provide my students, but also my colleagues, with as much information as I possibly can concerning small ruminants. There are so many different types of veterinarians in the world, and there are so many different things that you can go learn about when you're at a continuing education event or a conference or even just a local meeting. And what's going to happen is that you're going to select something to learn about that's kind of primarily lying in your area of interest, your area of expertise, what you see all the time, right? So for a 100% small animal veterinarian, they're going to focus on learning more about small animal practices. The food animal veterinarians like myself, we're going to go to things about goats and sheep and cattle and pigs and try to gain more information from those species. Now, one thing I will say, this is kind of an ever-growing concept in vet med. We're finding that, as Deborah mentioned, it's hard to find a small ruminant veterinarian. And there are a lot of students that are going through vet school right now that are extremely interested in small ruminants, that want to practice with small ruminants. I'm a firm believer that small ruminants can be brought to any practice. So as a veterinarian, you can get a few simple tools for your trade, have some knowledge kind of in your background, and apply this to whatever practice you're in, whether it's small animal, equine, dairy, whatever you're doing, and offer quality small ruminant medicine and surgery for your clients. The key, though, is quality, because just going out there and saying, oh, I dabble in sheep and goats, yes, deworm this whole herd, is a bad idea, right? So I will say that I'm doing a talk actually at the American Veterinary Medical Association this year that is how to bring small ruminants to your small animal practice. So I'm going to talk about some of the highlights of that, some of the basic things that those people need, talk about FMATRA scoring and running a McMaster's slide when looking for eggs, not just a fecal flotation, you know, talk about some of the things that are, to me, the backbone of small ruminant practice that even if you're a small animal person, if you do a few simple things, you're going to at least be able to provide triage services to somebody who's in need, right? Until maybe you could have another veterinarian that's more comfortable with it, or you can at least talk to a colleague. But it's important to remember that just like those producers that have done it for 20 years, if a veterinarian is not continuing to evolve their knowledge and they're really focusing on what they learned in vet school, it's probably not going to be accurate for what they could provide for you, because vet school is amazing. It was a lot of fun. I learned a ton, but I will say that goats in particular are not a main species that we learn about in vet school. They're just not. Different programs have different kind of focus. And we, as veterinarians, a member of the American Association of Small Ruminant Practitioners, it's one of my kind of passion organizations, we are working very hard to push for education about goats and sheep while students are going through school, and then continuing to provide them with educational opportunities through our organization so they can not feel that they don't know what they're doing at all. But if your veterinarian is recommending something that just does not align with what you've heard here from me, from other guests that Deborah's had that are PhDs, and or Deborah who wrote the book and did all the research, then you probably want to just, you know, consider that maybe it's an outdated practice, or maybe you should ask your veterinarian. What I would rather you do is have a frank conversation with them. Don't be afraid to ask questions. Personally, I love when people ask me questions. If you say, hey, look, this is what I read. I know we all hate sometimes this is what I read online, but it's a reality. Like, you should have that concern for your animal. And if it sounds odd, then ask them. And if you're uncomfortable with the answer they gave you, well, then you don't have to necessarily follow. You can find another veterinarian. You can find, you know, another second opinion. You can go to your local veterinary school or call your local veterinary school and ask for advice. And I'm by no means saying do not utilize your local veterinarians. Local veterinarians are there for you. As a profession, we're trying to serve you in a broader way. And I will say, I think the current and coming generation of veterinarians want to serve you and do it the right way. And I know that for a fact, because I've had students still that text me after they graduate, and we talk on the phone, we text back and forth about their goat case they're looking at and what they're doing for that case. So, you know, I think it is challenging sometimes to find someone who is an expert at small ruminant. Be patient with the people that are trying to provide you with services or help, and don't be afraid to ask questions, because that's part of our job, is to answer those questions for you.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks so much for that. That was really interesting.
Yeah, like I said, from a veterinary perspective, my colleagues that are out there trying to provide small ruminant practice options, I think are 100% trying to do the absolute best they can. And if they're willing to look at the animal and try to practice the best medicine, I think that, you know, it's good to develop that relationship where you work hand in hand with that veterinarian. Because I know that I learn a lot from my producers, my clients. You know, they teach me a lot, you know, about their animals that maybe I didn't know or recognize. And so, you know, have a little patience, especially if it's somebody saying, I love goats. I want to work on goats. I want to be the best veterinarian you can possibly have. They will do the legwork to find the information for you. So have patience with those people. Trust the veterinarians that say, I don't want to do this. Because they also have the foresight to understand that that's something they're not necessarily interested in or feel comfortable doing. And that's fine. That's not a problem. But I think what I have gained from working with students is that if they want to do it, even if they don't do it all the time, they're going to do it, and they're going to do it well, because they want to provide that service and they want to have you come back, right? So have some patience, especially with some of your newer graduates out there. I know there are a lot of bright young minds coming into the field every year, and a lot of them are just really interested in giving you the service that maybe you've lacked in your area.
Yeah, exactly. I know. I've heard some really great stories from people, you know, like somebody in Canada who was in a very remote area. And she said that the only vet in her area said, well, I used to see a couple goats a few years ago, but I'll do what I can to help you.
Exactly.
You know, I love it when I hear that they're being completely honest, that, you know, this is not their strong point, but they're willing to do what they can and learn as much as they can. One of the things that I just noticed in my notes here is that some people were talking about not just doing one repeat deworming, but like deworm every week for 3 weeks. Or there was even one person who posted a list of dates that she had had this goat that had a really bad case of worms. And she was giving her, like, I think she gave her every dewormer that is on the market. Oh. And it was almost every day for 3 weeks. And I've never seen it before. And she insisted that she did that on the advice of her vet. And it's like, that's just not going to help a goat, right?
Exactly. Oh, yeah. And, you know, so in this talk that I'm going to do at this American Veterinary Medical Association, one of the things that I'm going to try to really stress is that goats are not dogs, cats, small cattle, horses, right? So there are some practices we do in other species that are the antithesis of what we want to do in goats, right? It's the kind of anti-everything we are taught, that we've talked about this whole time. So hopefully. I really want a lot of my small animal colleagues out there who want to provide the best service to hear that and know that rotating dewormers, giving multiple days worth of three or four different types of dewormers, giving it every couple of weeks for 2 months, all of that is really, really not good practice. And it's actually the opposite of good practice. It's bad practice. And you're going to drive that farm's resistance. That animal may survive. And that sometimes I think for some people, both veterinarians and clients and producers alike, that is a win, but that's a short-term win, right? You got to think of your long game here. That goat survived, but next year, the year after, are all of the goats going to survive? Or are we going to end up in a situation like you had, Deborah, when you, like 5 or 6 years ago, or well, it was longer than that, was when you first started, that you lost all of your goats due to the fact that nothing worked. And I've seen it happening now. It's happening right now. I've had farms where literally they're losing their goats because nothing is working. And it's hard for me as a vet to say, I can't do anything for you. I'm sorry. All I can do is a blood transfusion. And even that, all I'm doing is giving you a blood transfusion saying, go back out and feed the worms. Here's some fresh blood. We're spiraling down a road that is not a good place to go because of practices like that. So please, please do not do that. And veterinarians, I hope if there's any veterinarians listening to this that are doing that, please stop recommending that. It is bad practice. Visit wormx.info. There are lots of good resources there for veterinarians as well, because veterinarians also serve on that consortium.
That is really interesting to know that that's something that is done and considered good practice with small animals, because that was one of the comments somebody said is like, well, it just makes sense that if this works with dogs and cats, that it would work with goats. And I don't know much about dogs and cats and that kind of stuff, you know, like I'm just your typical dog and cat owner. Right. So I didn't know when she said that, that like, oh, that really is a common practice with dogs and cats.
And it yeah, you know, I mean, no, it's totally different. You know, dogs and cats, it's not uncommon to have an annual deworm. It's not uncommon to give a dewormer. It comes back, you run a fecal and you're like, oh, it didn't work. Let's give another dewormer. You know, that's not uncommon. For horses, it's not uncommon to do multiple times a year deworming. So scheduled deworming is a part of animal husbandry, if you will, for multiple species, but it is not for goats. Absolutely not.
That is great. I'm so glad you said that. That is really good to know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, there's a lot of extrapolation that can be done between species, but that is not one of them. The barber pole worm is unique to goats and sheep. And that is where the problem lies. The barber pole worm is mutating and developing this resistance gene much faster than any other parasite.
Yeah, that is great. That's probably one of the best tips that we've had in this whole episode.
Good.
So is there anything else that you've heard that you want to mention?
You know, I think we've covered really a lot of the big myths. One of the things I just, again, want to kind of stress is take all advice with a grain of salt. You know, it's really easy to listen to somebody. And I've had multiple clients tell me, you know, they have a goat person that they talk to, you know, oh, they've been doing it for 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years, you know, and this is what they do. And they don't want to hear from anybody that that's wrong, you know, and it's like, well, if somebody is that set in their ways, I probably would take their advice with a grain of salt. Science is ever changing, and deworming practices are science. That's what it is. It's a medicine, right? So keep in mind that just because someone's giving you advice, be polite about it, say thanks so much, but do your research, do your own research. The fact that you're listening to this podcast is great. I'm so happy that you tuned into this. And, you know, I'm happy that people left those comments because I think it gave us a really great topic to discuss. And I have heard, I'm not even lying to you, even before Deborah told me about these posts, I've heard every single one of those myths with my own ears. So this is something that is, you know, inundated the market. It's not uncommon across the nation to hear these things. And it's our job as, you know, responsible goat producers, veterinarians, animal scientists, PhDs, it's our job to try and teach you guys with the most up-to-date information and the most relevant and hopefully the most reliable. So just one more shameless plug, visit the consortium's website at wormx.info. I know Deborah will have that in her show notes and have everything there for you guys as she always does, but that website is fantastic. And as someone who serves on the consortium myself, I can tell you that it is a great group of people that is constantly cranking out research and knowledge pertaining to barber pole worm and beyond, more parasites other than that. So check it out. You know, continue to follow Deborah. I love that she does these podcasts and that she invites people that, you know, are experts in their field. And small ruminant parasitism is something that I'm very passionate about. Hopefully you glean that from this discussion. And, you know, as always, if you have any questions, comments, concerns, hysteria, you know how to get a hold of me and you know how to get a hold of Deborah. So thank you again for having me on the show.
Oh yeah. Thanks so much for joining us today.
And that's it for today's show. If you haven't already done so, be sure to hit the subscribe button so that you don't miss any episodes. To see show notes, you can always visit fortheloveofgoats.com. And you can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/lovegoatspodcast. See you again next time. Bye for now.